is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
It's Wednesday, May 29, 2019, and this is the Baseball Tonight podcast. I'm Buster Olney. Our producer every day is Josh Macri. Josh, we got a lot to get through today. Start the clock.
Yeah, thanks to our friends at 60 Minutes for that one. Phillies and Cardinals, and before this game, word broke from Major League Baseball. Odubel Herrera has been placed on administrative leave. He was arrested on a domestic violence charge. According to Atlantic City Police, they responded to a casino Monday night and found Herrera's 20-year-old girlfriend with visible signs of injury to her arms and neck that was sustained after being assaulted by her boyfriend. That was from the Atlantic City Police. Herrera's facing a charge of simple assault. Gabe Kapler, the Phillies manager, talked about the situation.
Domestic violence is never acceptable, and obviously we're not in a position to talk about the specific incident with Odubel, but we are able to talk about it more globally, and it's unacceptable every time. I think it's an important enough issue where our players understood and are sensitive and aware enough to know that it is important to address as a group and to open up the conversation.
The leave can last up to 7 days while Major League Baseball officials look into the rest and can be extended while the investigation continues. Herrera's under contract for this year for 2020-2021 for a total of $17.7 million for the next two seasons, and he has club options for 2022 and 2023. The Phillies and Cardinals played last night despite a rain delay, and later, Cesar Hernandez came through for the Phillies.
Swing and a fly ball. It's a deep right field. That ball is way back there. It is gone. Goodbye. Up the facade of the second deck. Cesar Hernandez blasting one. And he has taken the Phillies from behind to in front in this game. Home run number six of the season for Hernandez. And the Phillies now lead 4-3.
Sports Radio 94 WIP, and that would be the final score. The Reds beat the Pirates. Derek Dietrich homered in the fourth inning, had another in the fifth, and then came to bat in the seventh.
Now the pitch to Dietrich, and he swings and barrels another one to right, and this one's gone. Three for Derek Dietrich, and all three are two-run home run.
That from 700 WLW. For the month of May, he's got 12 homers. His former team, the Marlins, have 16 for the month of May. Josh, after that third home run, I don't know if you saw the replay of it, he kind of gave a look to a dugout with the Reds and gave a little shrug like when Michael Jordan wasn't being guarded in the finals against the Jazz. Like, hey, they're going to pitch to me, right? Yeah. I'm going to hit it out.
No, exactly, and he's done it enough. He's earned the right to do the Jordan shrug, and I just got to say, yet another great personnel decision by the Marlins. Bravo.
Oof. Wow. They've actually been playing better of late, but they filled other teams with really good players. The Indians and the Red Sox, this game was rain challenge for sure. The Red Sox, however, had a 5-3 lead after a nice start by David Price. The top of the ninth inning, this is what happened.
Allen drives one to deep right. Down the line it goes. Gone! We are tied! On Greg Allen's first home run of the year. How about that?
How about that? Tom Hamilton, WTAM 1100. And you know what? That rally would continue.
Swung on, drilled. Deep right field. Back is Betts. Track, wall. He got a glove on it. Dropped the ball. Into scores Lindor. Mercado is following him home. Into second. Is Luplo and stopping at third is Santana. The Gold Glover, the MVP, got back near the wall, reached up, got a glove on it, and didn't catch it.
The final score there would be 7-5. Now, he's exactly right. Mookie makes that play 99 times out of 100, but even if he catches it, the Indians would have taken the lead. And again, the Red Sox bullpen blowing the lead. The Astros against the Cubs, and Alex Bregman has been red hot.
First pitch, and Bregman shoots this one out into right center field. Going back on it is Hayward at the wall. He leaps. It's gone. Second home run for Bregman. And the Astros back on top. It's 8-6.
Robert Ford, KBME 790 AM. The Twins play the Brewers. You know what the Twins do. They had a lot of home runs, and they continued to on Tuesday night.
CJ off second, and the 2-1 pitch, a swing and a rocket, right field and deep. Beckett goes, deep it goes, and gone! A line drive home to the porch and right, and Rosario goes deep again. His 17th this season, 5-0 Twins!
And they would hold on to win the game 5-3. That was Corey Provis on the Treasure Island Baseball Network. Minnesota with a 10-game lead in the American League Central. The Nationals and the Braves, and Howie Kendrick came through for the Nationals team that needed him to come through.
Kendrick, slightly open stance, Swarzak into the wind and the pitch. Hammer toward right center field and deep. Markakis and Acuna will watch it go into the right center field bleachers for a home run. Howie Kendrick with his 10th dinger of the season, and the Nationals extend the lead to 5-2.
And the final score would be 5-4 there. That from the Nationals Radio Network. The White Sox took a doubleheader from the Royals. Here was part of that.
And the pitch is smacked into center, base hit. Turning third on his way to the plate is going to be McCann. He will score without a throw. And we have a new ballgame. The White Sox have taken a 4-3 lead.
That from WGN. The Padres were in Yankee Stadium again. And in the first inning, they jumped all over Masahiro Tanaka. Eric Hosmer with a big blast.
1-0, that's going to go a long way. Dead central, car rushed. Dead center field, ball going, ball long gone for Eric Hosmer of the San Diego Padres. How about that for a start? Error, single, single, and hits the ball a ton for a three-run home run. 4-0, Padres.
There's no way, Josh, that our man was going to miss a trip to New York. Who was that call from?
Oh, of course not, Buster. Take that cross-country flight with Ted Leitner, of course, on 97.3 The Fan.
Deep center field. The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day, the Angels and the Athletics in the first inning. Oakland took a lead.
Marcus hits it to center field. Going back on it, Trout at the track. He will turn and watch it fly. And the A's take a 1-0 lead.
Ken Korak on 860 AM, The Answer. Tommy La Stella, however, answered back for the Angels in the top of the second.
Here's the next pitch. This is lifted in the air into center field. Going way back on it is Laureano. That ball's over his head. Angels get a run. They're going to get a second run on this one as the throw is offline in from the outfield. And delivering a pair of runs batted in is La Stella. And the Angels now have a 4-1 lead.
It was tied for all in the top of the ninth inning between the Angels and the Athletics. And Shohei Ohtani, who's had such an impact for the Angels since being activated, came through again.
Next pitch. That one is lined into right center, and that's going to drop in. One run will score. Trout's going to come in as well, and Ohtani delivers. Ohtani connects right there on a two-strike delivery, and the Angels are back on top. It's now 6-4.
Angels Radio, AM 830. And did you see what Joe Maddon said after the Cubs game? He's going to be getting a letter from the commissioner's office, I guarantee you. We'll be back to talk about all of that with Hembo. But first, I want to tell you about SeatGeek. Do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. So what if their site's annoying and doesn't have the events you want? Hello, status quo. The real question is, how easy could it be if those ticketing sites actually cared? With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. Search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. In an industry that tends to stagnate, SeatGeek decided to stand out from the crowd. They built the fastest way to find tickets, so you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. Why is SeatGeek better than the rest? A quick look at the App Store shows over 50,000 five-star reviews. How's that for customer satisfaction? It's a better process. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. Then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. Finally, SeatGeek displays them on an interactive seat map. SeatGeek breaks down the details. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are overpriced. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. It is by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. In fact, I've used the app to buy tickets to Hamilton, to baseball games, to hockey games. Anytime a friend calls and asks for tickets to a ball game, I go to SeatGeek. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code BUSTER for $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code BUSTER for $10 off on your first purchase.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Imbachidis, he's a researcher at ESPN who's the backbone of the show Get Up. And Hembo, you saw what Joe Madden said after the game, which, as I teased before, it's going to earn a letter from the commissioner's office, no doubt, because they do not like it when people in uniform fuel this conspiracy theory that the balls are juiced or something's going on. Specifically, here's what Madden said. I'm going to read his quote. There's definitely something going on. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I am not. You can really gauge it on the balls up toward the ceiling, too. The one that David Bodie caught literally almost hit the roof. Whoever wants to admit to something or not, I don't know if it's a combination of the ball or maybe the technology, the bat has gotten better. Maybe it's just purely about velocity, or maybe there's helium in this ballpark, but it's friggin' jumping, man. That was Joe Madden after the game last night. What do you think?
Well, first of all, let's talk about things that we know for sure. We know for sure that the per game home run average this year is on pace to shatter the all-time record. We're on pace for nearly 6,500 home runs, Buster. That would be about 1,500 more than we had just 5 years ago. So it would occur to me as extremely unlikely that we could see a jump that significant just by player strategy or by player skill. We also know that in the 5 years of StatCast tracking, the average exit velocity league-wide this year is as high as it's ever been. Now, I suppose that could be a result of some of the, you know, lesser hitters being weeded out and people using the technology. But I've read enough internet stories and think pieces to conclude what most around the game have. This is just sort of something that's being assumed. Pitchers around the game, all the reporting that I've read and all the, you know, interviews that I've heard, they all think so too. So this is not by any means something that's brand new, nor is this something that's not commonly understood around the game. In my opinion, Major League Baseball's standoffishness is sort of peculiar, because there's no question that over the last few years, the fabric of the game has been dramatically changed by the way that balls are flying out of the ballpark.
Well, and there's no question that Joe Madden saying that on the record is going to force Major League Baseball to deal with this publicly. Like, now, when you have the manager of the Cubs coming out and saying, yeah, there's something going on, and the ball is absolutely jumping, Major League Baseball is going to have to address this with a statement or however they choose to do it.
I'll also say this quickly, Buster. I also looked into this dynamic by individual stadium. And when you look at the highest rate of home runs on fly balls and on line drives, three of those five stadiums, Minute Maid, Miller Park, and Rogers Center, are domes. They're indoor stadiums. So I wonder if there's also part of this that pertains in that area where these teams can almost control the environment, their home's environment in which they play. I'm not suspecting foul play by any means, but it is very curious to me that three of the five most homer-friendly ballparks in that regard all have the opportunity to control their own environment. I mean, theoretically, that could help both teams, but that did strike me as curious.
The air conditioning companies are involved in this conspiracy. we'll see what Major League Baseball says. All right, you wanted to talk today about George Springer.
The Astros will be without him indefinitely, and while he might not be their best position player, he is arguably their most important. Over the last three seasons, Houston has won 65% of its games with him in the starting lineup while averaging 5.3 runs. Without him, the Astros have won 53% of their games while averaging 4.7. So with Springer, Houston owns the best offense in the league. Without him, it's a group that ranks outside the top 10, and when it comes to the leadoff spot specifically, the gap between his OPS and everyone else's during that time is 172 points. So when he goes, they go.
Yeah, perhaps the front runner in the American League for the MVP award, and he's going to have to sit for a while. The Minnesota Twins are killing the ball. What do you got on them?
Well, over the weekend on Twitter, you pointed out that the Twins led the majors in homers while ranking in the bottom three in strikeouts. So that obviously gave me an excuse for a research project. And here's what I found. Minnesota could become the fourth team in the last 25 seasons to lead the majors in homers while ranking in the bottom five in strikeouts. The Yankees last did it in 2009. That team won 103 games in the World Series. The Orioles did it before they did in 1996. That team reached the ALCS and featured seven different 20 home run hitters, a record that remarkably has yet to be broken. And then the Indians did it in 1995. That team owns the eighth best record of the live ball era, and it reached the World Series. That's pretty good company, if you ask me.
Yeah, I covered that 96 team for the Baltimore Sun. That was, by the end of the year, it was a crazy deep lineup. Your note to me is baseball's a young man's game again.
Those words, Buster, baseball is a young man's game, are words that apply now more than ever. Even I'm old enough to remember a time when veteran position players got paid. In fact, by average age, 10 of the 20 oldest seasons in Major League history for position players came in the 10-season span from 1996 to 2005, which happened to be the 10 seasons before the implementation of the Joint Drug Prevention and Treatment Program. Now, you've pointed out how veteran position players, especially one-dimensional ones, are now becoming extinct. And here's your proof. Through games played Monday, 20 different players produced more than two wins above replacement this season. Position players, that is. They all have one thing in common. They're all under the age of 30. The average player in that group is just 26 years old, and only three of them have accrued more than 6 years of service time. Freddie Freeman, Mike Trout, and Anthony Rizzo.
Wow. Which underscores the questions about why the Mets did what they did in the offseason. You know, at the time when the sport was getting younger, they got older, and we'll see if it pays off. Hembo, great stuff. Thanks for doing this.
Later, boys.
We'll be back in a moment with Boog Sciambi, the legend. But first, I want to tell you about Lightstream. Are your credit card bills keeping you up at night? Interest rates in the double digits? Be smart and pay off your credit card balances with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Get a fixed rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. You could save thousands in interest. Get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and there are no fees. You can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Plus, Lightstream is a division of SunTrust Bank, one of the nation's largest financial institutions, so you can have complete peace of mind. Want to save even more? My listeners get an additional interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/BBTN. That's lightstream.com/BBTN.
Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/BBTN for more information.
The man.
Swing and a high fly ball out towards left field.
The voice.
That one well struck. On its way. Out of here.
The legend.
And this place is going bananas.
Boog Sciambi on Baseball Tonight.
Boog Sciambi, play-by-play man for ESPN. And Boog, I hope you don't mind it, but you're sharing legend status on the show today because we have a call to the legend later in the podcast with Rick Monday, who tells great stories about grabbing that flag away from the two folks who were trying to burn it in the outfield 1976. Great stories about being the first player taken ever in the first Major League Baseball draft. So we call Monday a legend as well. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm in on that. Anytime. I do not deserve legend status compared to Mo, who I've known for a long time, and great broadcaster, great dude, really good player. Certainly remember watching him play as a kid.
Well, you are a legend for the great event you hold every year, and that's coming up tomorrow night. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we have the Tim Sheehy Gala is tomorrow night in New York City. All the information is pinned to my Twitter page. We actually have a live auction starting today, Wednesday, all sorts of cool auction items. Speaking of Rick Monday, one of the cool auction items, and I understand that this is, you know, we have some all sorts of really cool stuff, but I think my favorite item is we got Vin Scully to sign a media guide from his final season as a Dodger broadcaster.
Wow.
And that I just, and he doesn't sign a ton of stuff. And the front of the media guide is his picture. So it's his signature. And again, I'll be tweeting links out and that type of thing. But, we also have a softball tournament on Roosevelt Island in New York City, which is where I grew up and where I grew up with Tim Sheehy. He's a childhood friend. I'm 49 years old. I met Tim when I was 7. There's a group of a half dozen of us who all have known each other for that long, so over 40 years. Tim was diagnosed with ALS in 2005. He died in 2007. We started because he was just being crushed by cost with his disease escalating, and insurance didn't cover even basic stuff. So our foundation, a 501c3, all donations tax deductible, we help people living with the disease because that's an area of ALS. You know, hopefully they'll find a cure, but they hadn't done a ton in terms of helping the living, and that's what we try to do. We'll, you know, redo your bathroom to make it wheelchair friendly, get you a lift to get to the from the first to the second floor, buy you an eye gaze machine so that, you know, you could speak with your eyes through a computer the way Steve Gleason does. The name of our charity is Project Main Street. We partner with Team Gleason, and every dollar goes to help someone living with ALS. So the gala's tomorrow night. You can donate, auction items. It's all on my Twitter page, at Boog Shambi. If you want to do it, projectmainstreet.org is the other way. It's Main, but it's ST.org, not street, totally spelled out. So that's the deal. Tim, you know, Tim, the other thing is, you know, it's a way for us to remember our friend every year, you know, to think about him, and that's the other part of it. So it's a personal cause for me. And, you know, I'm my hope is that, you know, 10 years from now, I'm not doing this. But, yeah, this is something that's been very important to me for a long time since Tim died.
Well, you do great work with it. You get a lot of help. I saw on your Twitter page that some members of the Red Sox are going to be at the gala.
Yeah, so the Red Sox every year have supported and been givers, and it's been pretty amazing what Sam Kennedy of the Red Sox have done in supporting and giving money. We got signed stuff from Mookie Betts, and it's pretty cool. I appreciate you know, the Yankees as well. Brian Cashman donates his box every year, so you get 6 seats in the GM's box, you know, with food and drink, and he comes and hangs out with you. And I mean, you know, Brian as well as anyone, that is a really cool auction item, because Brian is as down to earth a guy as you'll run into. I don't know that if you could hang out in the general manager's box with 5 of your friends and a GM and sit there and maybe have a beer and a bunch of really good food and watch a baseball game. I don't know that there's too many guys you'd want to hang out with more than Cash.
Yeah, he does a great job of that stuff every year. All right, we heard from Joe Maddon earlier in the podcast with what he was suggesting, that the ball is juiced. You got the Cubs and the Astros tonight, doing the play-by-play on ESPN television. What was your take on what he said?
Well, I think the ball's juiced. It's the first thing I would say. But I'll also tell you this, and this is where the conversation needs to be nuanced. And I don't know whether you agree or disagree with this. But the thing that people do in this discussion that I think is wrong, I understand why they do it, but this is what takes place, Buster, is in establishing that the ball is different, if in fact it is established. And by the way, they're going to get their hands on baseballs, and by the second half, they will have enough data in first half baseballs collected, and it'll show that the ball is slightly different, in my opinion. Here's the flaw. Everybody just always assumes intent. They always assume intent. So that if it's established the ball is different, they did it on purpose. And I don't know that that's necessarily so. That's the part that I think is, you know, that where people need to be reasonable, and that this conversation needs to be nuanced. Even if they establish that the ball is different, it doesn't mean the league did it on purpose. And I'll add this. I am of the opinion, I'm not a conspiracy guy. In fact, I'm anti-conspiracy guy. And I think with every second that we're on this earth, I'm less of a conspiracy guy. And I'll tell you why. People suck at keeping secrets. And in today's world of social media and electronic transactions, there are too many trails. So that, like, if there was some grand conspiracy, hey, let's make the ball different, it would leak. We would find out. We would find out if there was intention to change the ball. So that's my take on it. And again, we could end up finding out that there was intention to change the ball. But I emphasize this idea that if we find out the ball is different, people always leap to the idea, oh, they did it on purpose. And no, you can't necessarily go there. That isn't necessarily so. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I 100% understand what you're saying, because I answer this sort of question all the time when you get the tweets that people will say, you guys just want the Red Sox or the Yankees to win, or you guys want Cody Bellinger to be the MVP. And I laugh at those because it suggests a massive conspiracy with the media. And Boog, you've been part of the media a long time. You can't get 10 people in a room to agree on anything, except as it's been pointed out to me on Twitter. Mariano Rivera, being voted in the Hall of Fame. That's the only thing on record that all reporters have ever agreed on. Right? And so I laugh.
It's amazing.
Given the disparate personalities and, like you say, the people who whisper, it's not like everyone gets into a room and does stuff. And look, I'll go back to my days of baking bagels for Jim Schramm at the bagel stop back in New Hampshire. The recipe was the same every day. The way we were taught to bake the bagels was the same every day, and some days the bagels would be different, Boog. And I think of a big baseball factory and the folks involved in that process. It's very possible that the baseballs are just a little bit different, and it is possible that there is a conspiracy, but I'm not buying it. I'm exactly where you are on this.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, though, that it would be. I mean, again, we showed it in a game in early May. I think it was actually a Twins-Astros game where we showed the data piece. But, yeah, Triple-A, for the first time, they're using Major League Baseballs. And the number of homers in April was almost double this year than it was last year. So there's something funny going on. I don't think there's any question.
All right, let's talk about Dallas Keuchel and Craig Kimbrell, who presumably are going to sign sometime after midnight Sunday night, because that's when the draft – Major League Baseball's draft is set to begin. They will be untethered at that point from draft pick compensation. And I'd start with this, Boog. I think that even though they're not going to be attached to draft pick compensation, that both players and their camps, more importantly, their camps, need to reset expectations for what they're going to get in free agency. We know that during the winter, Craig Kimbrell was looking for a six-year deal. In talking with teams all winter, no one's close to thinking that they're going to give him a six-year deal. I would think he might be able to get like a 3-year deal, maybe a 4th year. That might be the separator. And with Dallas Keuchel, look, I said it repeatedly, reported it during the wintertime. He asked his camp, Scott Boras, asked teams specifically for a 6 or 7 year deal for $25 to $30 million a year. Teams moved on. In the spring, the Astros offered him 1 year at $15 million or 2 years at $24 million. He said no at that point. What I've reported last night and I've heard is that now he's open to the idea of a 1-year deal for something close to the qualifying offer of $18 million. So those are the situations for these two players. I think they're going to both wind up signing for a lot less than maybe what they were looking for as the winter began. I want to ask you about which team you think could use each guy. And for me, I'll tell you flat out, I think if Keuchel's willing to take a 1-year deal, the Padres should be all over him because they're obviously playing well. They're hanging in the race. It's a 1-year obligation. They should be the team to sign him. And I think the Phillies, who don't have a budget in the same way I think the Braves adhere to a budget, the way the Nationals adhere to a budget, I think that the Phillies should be the team to sign Craig Kimbrell. What about you?
I, if It's hard. It's so hard for me playing this game, like, to pick the one. I would have gone Braves with Kimbrel just for fun, but I think that your choice is probably better. But as far as Keuchel is concerned, my out-of-the-box one would be the Cardinals, because their starting pitching just hasn't been that good. Their infield defense has been good. That would seem to fit well with a Dallas Keuchel. That park plays bigger than people realize. And they're in a spot right now where they need to be careful, because I think that they could be in some serious trouble. So, again, I think that there are a lot of teams that could use someone like Dallas Keuchel. I'm interested in terms of the point that you made. I mean, I would love to make a little bet with you. Some type of bet on the Kimbrel part of it. And we can put in, like, we can have, like, agents negotiate the terms of our bet and put in escalator clauses, or we could just have Max. And this is how he is not getting 3 years, and there's no way he's getting four.
Okay.
So
that's
my take.
I got that's it. Okay. And it's funny, because I did have one executive when I said, I think 3 and 4 might be the tipping point. Like, the team that gives him 4 years might be pushed over the edge to grab him. So we'll keep that in mind whenever he signs. You're saying he's not going to get 3 years.
I don't think he'll get 3, and I definitely don't think he'll get 4.
Okay. 60 seconds, American League. What are you seeing this year?
So bad. There's such a distinction between and look, let's call us out a little bit. You know, on ESPN, we do national broadcast. We have to have every team on. But, like, in the American League, we watch 4 teams. We got the Twins, the Astros, the Yankees, and the Red Sox. And obviously the Rays deserve to be in that conversation because they're really good. But otherwise, man, that league's tough right now. Everyone's trying to, you know, figure out, okay, how are we going to get this done in 3 years? Doesn't it feel that? I mean, think about where all these teams are, where the Orioles are 5 years away, the Blue Jays are a couple years away. You know, the Indians are in a really interesting rebuild, but, like, the Tigers, the Royals, the Rangers, all these teams that are like, yeah, you know, in a couple of years, we'll get back to you in a couple of years. It's just too much of that. And there are just these, and there are 4 to 5 really good teams in the American League. And otherwise, it's like, don't care.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Rays, because they're unquestionably one of the best teams in the American League. Boog, last night, they drew a crowd of 5,786. That's what the announced crowd was, and you and I both know that, of course, the actual number is lower. I saw some estimates on Twitter of about 1,200. According to our friend Mark Topkin, who first tweeted this out, the previous low was 6,509 on September 5th, 2017, when a hurricane was forecast. So think about that situation with the American League, even one of the good teams right now, not drawing a lot of interest. All right, Boog, good luck in your event. And again, you're a legend for all the work you do there.
Buster, thanks so much. I appreciate it, brother.
We'll be back in a moment with Rick Monday. But first, I want to tell you about DXL. Listen up, guys. If you're big or tall, you know what a pain it is to find clothes that fit. So a trip to DXL needs to be on your to-do list. At DXL, big and tall is all they do. They've spent years developing their own sizing patterns to make sure big guys get a comfortable fit every time. Pair that with over 100 brands, and you've got the one-stop shop for men's big and tall. Whether you're looking for jeans, hoodies, suits, or shoes, DXL's got you covered for every occasion in stores or online at DXL.com. DXL Big and Tall, built for you at DXL.com.
Time to make the call. Call to the legend on Baseball Tonight.
Rick Monday played 19 years in the big leagues, almost 2,000 games, hit 241 homers, a two-time All-Star. He played in the World Series 3 times, 1977, 78, 1981, and he's been a longtime broadcaster now broadcasting Dodger games on AM 570 LA Sports. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Buster. Good to hear you, although I would prefer to see you in person at the ballpark because that makes the trip to the stadium a little bit more complete.
Well, I appreciate that. The last time I remember talking to you about some of the great moments that you've had in your career, some great stories, and I'm glad that I got you on to ask you about them. And we'll start right at the beginning because you basically have had been in baseball your whole life. And I think probably what casual fans wouldn't know is that you were the very first player taken in any amateur draft for baseball in 1965. You were 19 years old. You were the first pick in that first draft. And I've thought about this through the years that, I mean, now when you see a guy like Zion Williamson taken first in the NBA draft, the question is, you know, will he try to manipulate the draft and perhaps, you know, if he doesn't want to play with the Pelicans, push his way to another team? When this happened, when this whole change happened where Major League Baseball teams voted for the draft and you're sitting out there as the player who's going to be taken first, what was going through your mind? Or how much were you aware of all the back and forth with this?
Well, it did not have the exposure, Buster, that it has today. And with great interest, I look at the draft and how it's set up and really the coverage that baseball gets out of it and the players, too. And I can kind of sympathize at times with the guys that, that may be selected as number one that, that maybe are not. But if we go back the number of years right before that first draft took place, playing at Arizona State, we were actually playing in Omaha in the College World Series when the draft came up. You know, it was not covered on radio. It was not covered on television. You did not have internet. It was basically telephone or tell a friend. And that was kind of it. And we were waiting in uniform down the right field line at then Rosenblatt Stadium to play a game, College World Series, the biggest stage we'd ever played on to that particular point in our young lives. And we knew about what time the draft was going to take place, but nobody understood how it was going to work. And all of a sudden, these reporters start to walk down from the press box towards the right field line where we were all sitting and waiting for the game to be completed on the field. And our coach, Bobby Winkles, had told Sal Bando and Duffy Dyer and myself and some other guys who were going to be drafted off of that terrific team that we won the NCAA championships with, said, "Hey, guys, I'm going to keep the media away from you so it does not disturb you trying to play the game." So that's how the first exposure was. And you talk about manipulating maybe wow. the salary structure on a bonus. I had some attorneys come to me and say, "Look, Rick, what we need to do is to take this to court. It's unfair now with the system. And we can beat this system and get it done." And I asked them a very simple question. "How long might that take?" And they said, "Well, it'll take at least a couple of years." I'm not interested. Because at that time, being 19, you could look at then the Kansas City A's and say, "Look, there's two things that happen. One, I can chase a dream that I've had since I was a little kid, the chance to play professional baseball. And then if you look at the team that had some aging veterans and then a lot of really great young players with the Kansas City A's, had a chance to make it to the big leagues a little bit more rapidly than I would have had I signed with a team that was a contending team at the time."
Now, you mentioned about the reporters coming to you. So it was at that point, the reporters coming over, they informed you that you were the first pick in the draft?
They were, yes, because the scout for then, the Kansas City A's, Art Lilly, had told me, he said, "Hey, we're going to draft you number one." Then I had two or three other teams, and I was talking out of high school with about eight different teams. All the while, I was talking and going and visiting some campuses on colleges where I may want to go. Well, I settled upon Arizona State, having met Bobby Winkles, which is one of the best decisions that I ever made. He made one promise to my mother, a single parent. He says, "I will take very good care of Rick." That man told her 100% truth. That's the way he handled everyone that went through his program at Arizona State. But oddly enough, it was one of those situations, Buster, where I've been talking to about eight different teams, and two or three of them said, "Hey, if they don't draft you number one, we're going to draft you number one." But again, nobody really understood how the system was going to work, what the signing window was going to be, what happens if you don't sign, you go back into the draft, the exposure. It was, you talk about archaic. I mean, this was a trial run, but it was for real.
And so did you feel, I'm curious, at that time, at, you know, you're a teenager, did you feel like when you heard about that that they had decided to have a draft, that something was effectively being taken away from you in terms of choices?
No, well, in terms of choices, possibly. In terms of opportunity, the door is open, and open very wide. Because, again, the opportunities to be at the big league level were going to present themselves much more rapidly within the Kansas City A's than they would have been with someone else. The real oddity on this thing is that one of the teams that was trying to sign me out of high school in Southern California were the Dodgers. And the scout that was trying to sign me was Tommy Lasorda then, who was the scout. And he actually had my mother and I to dinner one night. My mother, a single parent, had a contract in front of my mother. So, look, we want to sign Rick to a contract and put a very sizable number on this contract. And my mother had pen in hand. She had pen in hand the first time. She put it down and said, no, Rick needs to go to college. Tommy took the contract back, wrote another number in there that was very, very generous. My mother had pen in hand, put it down again, says, no, he's going to go to college. He could get hurt. He has something he can fall back upon if he gets hurt and can't make it. And then finally, Tommy pulled back the contract the third time and put on this contract more money than my mother could make in a number of years. And she put the pen down again and said, no, I'm not going to sign off on my son's future. He needs to get at least the start of a college education. And who would have thought that years later, when I get traded to the Dodgers, it's Tommy Lasorda's first year as a Dodger. And Buster, real quickly, I asked him one spring training when we've got a rain delay before we could take the field at Dodger Town at Vero Beach. And Tommy was talking about, you know, I tried to sign Rick as a kid. His mother was there. We took him to dinner. She was ready to sign the contract. She didn't. And I told him, I said, Tommy, I have to ask you a question. He said, what's that? Well, at the time, I was playing for a Dodger rookie team, which they would invite high school seniors that had just graduated, of whom they were trying to sign to a contract. And we played a couple of games, about 20 games, in fact. And we're playing in San Diego against the Marine Corps All-Star team, and Tommy has me batting second. And I said, Tommy, I need to ask you something. You won't remember it, but a number of years ago on the Dodger rookie team, you had me hitting second. The first guy that was up for us walked on four pitches, and we're playing against these Marines. You know, I'm 17, just out of high school at the time. The first guy walks Buster on four pitches that are not within 2 feet of the plate. I'm the second hitter that day. I look down to Tommy, who's coaching at third. He gives me the hit-and-run sign, which means I have to swing at that next pitch. The runner takes off. The pitch is about chin high. I reach up. I hit it, and it goes for a home run. And as I'm coming around to third base, I was sticking out my hand, but Tommy would always shake your hand and pat you on the backside. He didn't. He walked away from me. So now, years and years later, I'm in Dodger Town. I ask him, Tommy, you're not going to remember this. But he goes, what? I said, I've always wondered why you didn't shake my hand, but I know you're not going to remember it that day. He goes, the heck I don't remember it. There were 12 scouts in the stand. I wanted you to look bad. The first guy walked on four pitches. I wanted them to think that you had absolutely no discipline, didn't know the strike zone. He goes, I was mad that you hit the home run.
Oh, boy. I was going to say, your mom must have been an incredibly strong person, because I can imagine Tommy Lasorda in that situation being an unbelievable salesman.
Well, he was. He was. I mean, he took us to the stadium. You know, we grew up, we were Dodger fans. I heard you a little earlier saying, as a kid, you were not a Yankee fan. Well, I fell into that same category because they always seemed to be on television. And with exception at the time, in the time that I saw them as a kid and playing and relating to them, I did not like the Yankees except for a guy that wore number 7, that being Mickey Mantle. My wife has a great saying. It's very seldom is it as good as the brochure. Well, when I first met Mickey Mantle and I'm playing against him, and a kid that I used to watch on the television or listen on the radio, and now I'm a youngster, and my second full year in the big leagues, I'm on the American League All-Star team, and I'm a teammate with Mickey Mantle. That's one of those pinch me moments. When someone that you believe is bigger than life and walks into a room and recognizes you as Mickey did in the locker room, the American League All-Star locker room, he comes up, Rick, how are you? And it's one of those moments that you never forget. It's like all of a sudden your feet are not on the ground. They're about a foot or 2 feet off the floor level because this guy has absolutely blown you away.
And all I've heard about him is what a, you know, teammates and people played against him, what a great guy he was, too. Well, I'm sure that's the experience you got.
Very quickly is that I had no idea on how much that man went through. Yes, it was towards the end of his career. But he was basically taped from ankle up to his hips and wrapped and everything else. But what this guy had, more than just the presence on the field, he had a presence just as large when he was off the field.
Without a doubt. No question about it. The last time I saw you, we had this fun conversation about what happened in Dodger Stadium, April 25th, 1976. You're playing against the Dodgers, and a couple of folks run onto the field with a flag, and they're trying to light it on fire. It's an iconic moment in baseball history. And I asked you the last time we talked about, people remember that happening. What happened with the flag? And you had a story about that.
Well, no one knew how big that deal was. The only thing that we really had for a number of years, and it was enough. I mean, the wonderful call that Vin Scully made of that moment and the reaction of the crowd. We did not find out. This was 1976. We did not find out until 1984 that there was actually someone had documented it, shot it on their own camera, and then bumped it over to videotape. So 84 was the first time that we knew that we had anything other than Vin Scully's radio call and the photo that the late James Rourke took, who was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, having taken that photo of that particular instant. But after the game, I had requested that if I could have that flag. I was notified they were going to have a court case. They were fined $80 a piece and put on 2-year probation, and we all moved on. Well, the court case took place, and when the Dodgers came back into Chicago and playing for the Cubs at the time, the late Al Campanis, the general manager, presented me with that flag. The irony of it is, I guess, if we go full circle, is that the very symbol that they were attempting to desecrate that afternoon. That for me, yes, my thoughts, it was the way I was raised. And then those thoughts were reinforced by serving 6 years in the United States Marine Corps Reserves while I was playing in Major League Baseball. My thoughts are is that flag represents the rights and freedoms that we all have if we choose to take them. And I was angry at that particular moment when they came on the field, angry to begin with because I thought they were just interrupting the game. It was the middle of the fourth inning and pitch had already been made in the bottom of the fourth. And from center field, I could all of a sudden hear something off to the right and looked over and here's these two guys, not knowing what it was that they were trying to do. But I felt that what they were trying to do once I saw the flag was wrong. I felt that way then. I reinforced, I still feel that way. But the irony is that the very flag that they were attempting to desecrate, my wife Barbara Lee and I now are able to take it across the country. She's taken across the country herself, 14 states in 14 days. We've been privileged enough to raise some money for some wonderful charities and that's helped veteran families, military families. And that flag still has a life. And from time to time, we're, again, honored enough to take it out and try and do some fundraisers with it.
Rick, do you go a day in your life without someone bringing up that moment?
Not often. Not very often. I'm proud to have been there. And the people that I'm privileged to know would have all done the same thing had they been geographically as close to it as I at that particular moment. I'm proud that I was over there, and from an amusing standpoint, I'm really glad I did it because Buster, the last thing I ever wanted was for one of my Marine drill instructors to ever get a hold of me and say, "Hey, Marine, why don't you stand there and watch them burn the American flag?" Well, I didn't have to worry about that, and we can all move forward and see it. But to me, it's a special moment that I feel privileged, and I was close enough to do something about it.
Man. And I told you when we talked about how in 1981 I was a high school senior. I was running on a cross-country team as a huge Dodger fan, and you guys were playing the Expos in the playoffs, and I lingered in the trainer's room to hear the end of that game. I got to hear your home run off Steve Rogers, and I got to the practice, and I got in huge trouble from my coach for being late. And I explained to him what happened, and he smiled. He took it easy on me. I didn't realize at that point he was a Dodger fan too. Take us back to that moment, because that is a reaction when you hit that home run is one of the ones I'll never forget.
Well, I think if you're looking at that series, first of all, two extremely talented teams, the Montreal Expos and the Dodgers, and it comes down to kind of a theater ending, if you will, because the Sunday game, which would have been the final game to decide who was going to face the Yankees the following Tuesday, because the Yankees had already clinched the American League pennant, that Sunday game was rained out. It was before the roof had been really applied where they could use it at Olympic Stadium. So we had to play on Monday. It turned out it was probably an advantage for us, the visiting team, because not as many people were there. The place was not as loud. It was not as deafening. We continued to hear Valdery and Valdero, the happy wanderer, being, you know, sung and played during the entire game. But Ray Burris and Fernando Valenzuela pitched a terrific game. And then towards the end of the game, we get close to the ninth inning, and we see Steve Rogers starts to go down and warm up in the bullpen. Well, he had just, I think, shut us out like 2 or 3 days prior to that. And we were surprised he was going down there. We understood, as a heck, here's a cold, damp afternoon. The winner of this game is going to play the Yankees the next night in New York. And the Expos had a plane at the airport. The Dodgers had a plane at the airport. And when Rogers entered the ballgame, I really thought in the ninth inning that Ron Say had hit a home run. And it turned out that Tim Raines in the cold, cold, damp air caught the ball in the warning track. And I remember in reflection and thinking, there's not a ball in the world that's going to go out of this ballpark if that doesn't go out. And then with two outs, I'm the hitter. And Steve, one of the rare times that he fell behind, a 3-1 pitch that I knew I hit really well, but I did not really know the flight of the baseball. I knew it was hit well, and at first I went, oh, darn, it's hit to the big part of the outfield, and it's not going to happen. Going down the first baseline, I was watching Andrew Dawson playing in center field. I said, well, maybe he'll run out of room. Maybe it'll be off on the high wall that's out there. And I did see the ball just as it went over the fence, and we took the lead at the time and still had to get the Expos out of the ninth, and they were coming back, too. That series itself was probably with more excitement with every pitch, with every swing, with every catch, than even the World Series that we were fortunate enough to finally right the ship from our standpoint, 81, and beat the Yankees for the World Championship.
I agree with you. I feel like that Expos team and the Expos team from the strike year in 94, maybe the two teams are going to be lost to history of just unbelievable talent that they had. But you guys wound up prevailing. Now, when did you decide you're going to become a broadcaster, that would be something you'd want to do? Because certainly, I mean, your voice is terrific. But for some people, it's not something to necessarily consider. Who brought that idea to you?
Probably an eighth grade teacher, only from a standpoint is that I don't know if you could whisper in class. Every time I tried it, I got busted. And I finally, my voice changed in the eighth grade. And it changed an embarrassing moment because I was in front of the class reciting the Gettysburg Address. And and that was the moment that, from 47 years ago. And it was kind of an embarrassing moment, but it was after I was playing, the last 5 years that I played, for the Dodgers, during the off season, I was working at ABC television in Los Angeles to kind of learn about the business, understand if it's something that you want to do, go out with a reporter, understand how to maybe put an interview together, how you're going to do a stand up open or a close or do a bridge and do a voiceover in the studio and edit. And it kind of intrigued me. And then when I retired from baseball, my last year playing 84, I was offered an opportunity to anchor the sports for then the Dodgers station that they televised on, KTTV in Los Angeles, which was the predecessor to Fox in L.A. And I anchored the sports for 4 years. I did not really enjoy the studio work as much as I enjoyed the field work. And then the opportunity came up to do some of the Dodger games on cable. And then I went to San Diego with the Padres for 4 years, and then joined the Dodgers full time in 1993. So I'm around a lot of the people I've been around my entire life. I love the game of baseball. I find it fascinating, and it's the old stories at Buster's that almost every time we go to the ballpark, we're liable to see something that we have never seen before. And whether we dive into the rule book or just have conversations, this game of baseball is fascinating, and so are the people involved in it.
You're 100% right about that. I always loved watching you play, and I love listening to you, Rick. It's always good to talk with you. Thanks for doing this.
I'll see you down the road. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Because we're tired of getting yelled at for somebody else's work.
Bias!
And would rather get yelled at for the stupid stuff that we do.
And this is why the Seattle Mariners will play in the 2016 World Series.
Oh, what a loser!
This is the Baseball Tonight Power 10.
And, of course, this week's Baseball Tonight Power 10, Josh, it has to start with the Astros. Because they have been dominant. They're rolling through. I've got Astros 1, Twins 2. Who you got?
Buster, what's the matter with you, man? What's the matter with you?
What are you talking about?
I think you're over-reliant on what the expectations were for certain teams coming into the season, and that's why you're disrespecting my Twins and Rena Bonina's Twins.
Wow.
The Twins are...
My Twins!
Yeah.
Listen to you, you bandwagon dude! Wow! Jeez!
The Twins are number one, Buster. The Astros are two. Then I have the Dodgers at three and the Yankees at four.
Boy, the other day when I did a Power 10 on Sunday morning, I'll send that out. The response that I got back was pretty amazing because I had so many Yankee fans saying, "Why are we behind the Twins?" And then I had a few Twins fans saying, "What a joke that you put us behind the Astros." You can't make anybody happy with these things, which is why we do it. So I've got the Twins at two, Dodgers three, Yankees four, Rays five, Cubs six. Who you got three through six, Josh?
Whoa, yeah. So as I said, I got the Dodgers at four, the Dodgers at three. That's the second time I screwed that up. The Yankees at four. Then I have the Philadelphia Phillies at five, the Cubs at six.
Okay, I've got Philly seven, Braves eight, Red Sox nine, Oakland 10.
The Red Sox do not deserve to be in there. Oakland at seven, Tampa at eight. A big discrepancy between where you have the Rays and where I have the Rays, Buster.
You're wrong.
Okay. Yeah, well, you're wrong at the top. I'd rather be wrong at the bottom than wrong at the top. Rays at nine. Rays at eight. Man, oh man, I'm struggling today. Rays at eight. Braves at nine. Bob Uecker's Milwaukee Brewers closing it out at 10.
How about you, the bitter Red Sox fan, upset about the bullpen, refusing to put him in the top 10.
Man, oh man. But I will say, going through the highlights at the top of the show, I did take solace in the fact that Tom Hamilton had those calls, and you could hear his voice reverberating off the rain-soaked empty seats at Fenway Park. What a mess, Buster.
That's so funny you said that. I thought is about saying it when I heard that highlight. Man, you could hear that bounce off the green monster.
Exactly. So I don't mind seeing the Red Sox lose when I know that I'll get to hear Tom Hamilton with a great call the next morning. Kind of makes it worth it. Kind of takes the sting off. But what are you going to do? But Buster, get on board. Rena, me, the rest of the great North, the Minnesota Twins, Buster. Catch the fever.
Bleacher Tweets.
What do you say we close it out with some Bleacher Tweets, Buster? Maybe we can agree on some answers here. First one comes from Fielder's Choice at weekend_plans. Coming out of the Memorial Day weekend, the Indians and the Mets have identical records. They're both at 500. We hear so much about the Mets hot seat, but which team are you actually more concerned about?
Oh, the Mets, no question, because the Mets went all in. Like, they devoted resources to win this year and next year. Well, on the other hand, and we've talked about this, about the Indians, their front office is trying to thread the needle, trying to remain competitive and trying to not have a situation where they have to go into a rebuilding / tanking down cycle. And they're hanging in there. Like, they're in the wild card race in the American League, so definitely the Mets.
They are, but they're 10 games back in the AL Central, which brings us to this Bleacher Tweet from T. Jones at TNJ629. Are the races in the aforementioned AL Central and the Goat Rodeo, the NL West, already over?
I'm not ready to say the National League West race is over, although I do think the Dodgers will win. American League Central, 10 games. And I do think this will shape some of the Indians' decisions about when to trade Trevor Bauer.
Finally, We had a packed show today, Buster. So only three Bleacher tweets. We'll close it out with this one from Gareth Spark, at Gareth Spark. Is it too sentimental or is it fair to say that Dustin Pedroia would have been a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame if he'd not been injured and had continued his pre-injury production, even with likely regression due to age until the end of his current contract? His WAR was over 50 through 2017, keep in mind.
Yeah. And Gareth, I got a similar email yesterday after our podcast from Hembo, who disagreed with my assessment about Pedroia's Hall of Fame chances. I think he's a borderline candidate. Hembo thinks he's a little bit better. But let's face it, if he was able to play in 2017, 2018, he would have hit those important benchmarks like 2,000 hit, 1,000 runs. I do think it's going to impact his chances or how quickly he gets voted in the Hall of Fame if he actually does get in.
I agree. And he was one of my favorites. I have his jersey. Love the guy. He's certainly not a Hall of Famer. Some Hall of Fame Bleacher tweets today. Yeah, not a great segue, but we'll go with it. Keep them coming. Use the hashtag Bleacher tweet.
Man, I had so much fun talking to Rick Monday. I got to talk to him for another hour. He's got so many great stories. My thanks to him. My thanks to Boog Shambi, to Paul Imbakides, and to Josh Macri, who produced this podcast every day. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.